listening to the AHDB podcast, practical know-how to help your farm business.
Well, hello everyone. I'm Nick Renison and I work for AHDB. And today I'm joined by Ian Norbury, who farms down in Cheshire. And we're going to be talking about his 3-year strategic farm journey and probably a bit of a focus on his grassland management. So Ian, hello, and thank you for joining us. Can you just introduce yourself, a bit about your background?
Yep, so I'm Ian Norbury. I farm in Mobley, Cheshire. So the farm sits literally right on the end of Manchester Airport runway number 2. So those of you who've been to the farm would know the planes are very, very low. So that's where we're located. Lived here all my life, born here, and then my parents ran it as a dairy farm. So I was raised on a dairy farm. They were quite intensive dairy. They weren't pedigree, but they were very high inputs and high outputs. Left school, always wanted to be a farmer from day one. In the blood. The primary school was actually situated in part of the farm, like land. So primary school could see the farm all day long and what was going on and stuff. And just definitely had the bug for it anyway.
What made you think, oh, actually, I want to wear wellies on my own farm full time?
So I'd still be helping out a weekend, and I worked on a self-employed basis, so I'd still go helping farmers harvest time a little bit. Generally, I'd have like a bit of a 6-week holiday and go digging potatoes and helping my dad out when he needed. More really just family. Like my dad got to the age where he couldn't really carry on running the farm on his own. And like I say, I was born here. My grandfather brought it in 1963. I'm very community spirited and very big into Mobley, and I used to be on the parish council and stuff and do a lot for like, you know, local Rose Day fetes and stuff like that. So I'm quite tied to the village. I'm quite a homely person. So in my eyes, I don't mind staying here till the day I go, be honest.
So at that point, did you have sucklers?
So my dad had, this is a really good question. And, I did a lot of stuff around grass-based dairy stuff by being involved in building the dairy parlours and other bits of stuff. I met a real good network of top grazing people through doing that and really good consultants. And I paid for this top consultant to come out once and sit with me and dad. And that was a really pinnacle question that he asked. He was like, well, what made you go into sucklers? And it wasn't really a conscious decision or a business decision. It was more just we'd gone out of milk, I'd gone off farm, and it was just a natural progression that my dad would just go into sucklers. Hobby farming is the wrong thing, but my dad would never, he never really looked at it as a business. In his day, he didn't. So he was the first person in the village to have a dairy parlour. Very forward thinking and very fortunate because the farm set up really, really well. But he never went on holiday. He didn't really spend that much time with us. He wouldn't probably look at stuff as a business decision. He'd just be like, oh, well, we need that, or the cows need that. And you know, we'll build a new shed because we've got 4 more cows. So we need like a nice big shiny shed to put them in. And not worry about like the cost of production or how he was going to, he would probably worry about how he was going to pay it back, but he wouldn't sit down and maybe work it out, and it'd all just tend to pan out for him. So yeah, so he just naturally went into sucklers because he wanted to keep cows. So he brought a few cows, kept a few of our old dairy cows and bred off them and stuff, and probably ran like 50 to 60 suckler cows, calving down over a really wide period. So it'd probably turn them out, just turn the Angus bull out of them and leave them in with them and then probably carve over. I think when I came back, I think we were carving over nearly 22, 23 weeks, which is a big long time to be carving. And then, of course, everything's all different ages.
Carving at what age? What age around?
So he'd be carving at 3 years plus. I don't mean to sound like I'm having to go at him because I'm not.
Because, I think it was very normal.
Yep.
And I don't think he will be, he would have been by himself. And he's by himself in lots of situations.
And he was happy doing that. And it provided him with what he needed to get through and stuff. And that was great. You know, I'm not knocking him at all. And, you know, stuff he did when he was in the dairy, he was really forward thinking. in his time. And I suppose he's just got to that age now where he just wasn't interested or didn't want to take any more, anything more on.
So in 2016, you applied to be an AHDB strategic farm.
Did.
And you were successful. So your strategic journey, you're kind of coming to the end of your 3 years now, aren't you?
Yep.
And so you'll have, what things have you done in that time? You know, what have you implemented? Loads of things.
So lots and lots of things. So we've upped numbers. So I got given a really good consultant, James Hadwin. He's a farmer himself. So we've upped numbers from, I think when we started, I'd maybe got numbers up to maybe 70 suffer cows. We're now going to carve, we're now carving down 120. I think we were carving over, like I said before, 22, 23 weeks. We now carve over 12 weeks, which really worked really, really well, all tightening that up. We tightened that up really fast by using more bulls and checking fertility and bits of stuff like that. And just luckily, it did tighten up really, really quickly. We stopped using minerals. So we're now bolus, which has saved us a lot of money. That's one thing I worked out. We worked out we were spending £22 a head on mineral licks.
Wow.
So now we blood test and bolus, so we can target what the blood test is telling us and target what they're short of if they need anything. We don't really routinely worm, so we do egg fluke counts with the vet. Work really close with our vet as well, so we have our own dedicated vet within the practice, which works really well. Saves a lot of time because she knows what we're aiming for. She knows our cattle inside and out, so I can speak to her on the phone and she can say straight away yes or no. She thinks it'll be this, that and the other. And she's supported me a lot as well. Mm. With like the big changes we've made. And also being part of this, they've opened up opportunities to do colostrum testing. So the year we changed the minerals, we did a colostrum study with Edinburgh University. And that was really good to double check that everything was like it should be and the calves were getting the nutrients and stuff they needed. So, it's just monitoring them changes.
What about EID and the weighing? What was your weigh scale situation before?
I had two test weigh scales and an Easy Weigh 7, and I'd actually started tagging animals a couple of years before with EID tags, and then seeing how much a reader was and stopped doing it because I was like, I'm never going to pay that much for a reader. And then literally by being part of this and being loaned like the state-of-the-art weighhead and a stick reader, I think I still had one or two left that still had like the EID tags in. So when the stick reader landed, I went and tried it and it was so quick and so impressive that literally I think I'd had the stick reader maybe 24, 48 hours and I'd gone and spent money and brought reusable tags for every animal on the farm. So I went in and re-tagged everything with EID. And yeah, I say this every time because TrueTest or DataMars will probably listen to this. And I say it every time. I shouldn't say it, but there's no way that kit will be going back. That just saves me so much time. It's so quick.
Yeah, yeah.
It eliminates mistakes. Because I'm on my own a lot of the time as well. Mm. When I do have people in to help, they're maybe not people that are used to being around livestock. And I perceive the most dangerous place being in the back, pushing cows up the race. So I'm always in the back. So getting someone to write tag numbers down or put it into a weigh head, you know, I'm going to make mistakes doing that. They're definitely going to make mistakes doing that. So it means they can just stand there with a stick reader, press the button, everything else is automated. And yeah, just I'm a massive pro EID. And it really frustrates me they don't just make it mandatory because it just makes TB testing and everyone's life so much easier, so much safer, so much quicker. The cows go through the race a lot better because you're not messing about near the heads. It just makes the whole thing a lot more enjoyable. And then all that now links to farm software we use, some medicine books and farm assurance and everything's so much easier. Grouping of cows. It's so much easier because you scan that group and you can put them on the computer and you know that group's 100% right, that them 18 have gone to the ball, click of a button, and yeah, just really, really good.
So are you, you're calving now at two?
Yep.
And you might have said this already, but how tight is your calving?
So we carve over 12 weeks. Right. Well, we did do last year. We got it down to 12 weeks. This time we PD'd that hopefully we should be 12 weeks, even though we did have a few problems with, we had a bull that went lame and then another one that injured himself and had to go. But yeah, still PD'd really, really well. So PD'd at 90, just under 98%. So we PD'd really, really well. Even in the drought, I think 2018 when it's really hot, I was a little bit nervous then. But yeah, PD'd really, really well then as well. So that's just another reassurance that, like, you know, changes with the minerals and other stuff we're doing is working right. And we're pushing numbers to the bulls as well. We're putting, like, this last time we were putting over 60 to a bull. So they're working
hard. And how many are you calving this spring?
So this spring, we're aiming for 120, but we'd be just under. I think we'd be like 115 to 117, something like that.
And if I ask you to explain or describe your perfect cow,
yep.
What? How much would she weigh? And
perfect cow would weigh 650 kgs. Mm. I'd carve it down at two. So it'd be weighing probably 80% of its full weight when I carve it down, because I'm still going to grow it in that first year of it having that calf on it. I manage them in a separate group. It's really important how you manage them heifers. You're carving down at two, you've still got to allow them to grow. You don't want them getting bullied. You've got to look after them in their first year with the calf, because obviously you need them to get back in calf as well. Yeah. I'm wanting her to last at least 8-9 years, really. And yeah, this time, to be fair, 100% of the heifers we carved down at 2 years were back in calf. So that was really, really good. The year we up numbers quite a lot. We kept all heifers back. So we carved down 45 heifers and we'd brought 17 of them in. And we did have a few issues then. We didn't have a great calve in that time. And calving's really important to us. We want small calves that grow fast. Yeah, and we're dead. So we've got CCTV. We use MooCall. We monitor calving really, really extensively. So we collect a vast amount of data. So we collect, like, condition score at calving ease, dam docility, weight of the calf when it's born. And collecting all that information is all heading for our end goal, that when we get numbers to where they want them to be eventually, then we've got all that data to start culling stuff out, and we can monitor how stuff's performing. Or if we've got that data, we can look back over the calving period if we have had a bad calving and go, well, there was this problem here, and see any traits or links and bits.
And you'll be selling some bulls.
Yeah, so do pedigree bulls as well. So we're probably, I bet we're near 50-50 now, pedigree and commercial cow-wise. So anything that's entire as a pedigree male would stay entire, because we can just sell them. We don't treat them any differently until weaning, really. And then we've got a lot of footpaths, so we'll house them then and give them a little bit of cake, but not a lot at all. And they are grass based. We don't push them at all. And I do really enjoy doing that. We're just in a pretty bad area for TB. And it's another string to the bow. Like, so my long term goal would be probably try and get to near 150 suckler cows, and then start culling out and cull any ones out that are giving us problems, and have more pedigree stock. Sell them using Sell My Livestock. Like, even once we got numbers up, look to sell heifers. And then I know the dead weight market, so we sell everything dead weight. So I know what it's worth on a hook. So yeah, if I can get more for them selling them live and enjoy doing that more, then that's great. But if I can't, I know what they are dead. So
you touched then on grass and grass based. Can you give us a whistle stop tour of, because you have moved to rotational grazing? I don't think you were doing it before you started, were you?
So I was playing around with it. I was playing around with it a little bit, and probably a bit more strip grazing. Wasn't dropping in back fences. And to be dead honest, I went to one of the progressive beef group farms who had met on something else I'd done, Rob Priest. Once I got accepted onto this, he was doing a similar thing, and he was having an open day. And I thought I'll go down and see him because it'd be really good to see him. And also I'll be able to see what it's all about and see what's going to be expected of me. So I went down to his open day, really, really good. And I saw these troughs, which basically you'd run like your water pipe over the ground, just like a little plastic pan trough that'll feed like 45 heifers. And I was like, if I'd seen it on the internet or I'd seen it in a shop, I would have just laughed at it and gone, mine had trashed that. But knowing Bob and actually seeing it myself, I was like, I need to get one of these. And that was a really big turning point in rotational grading because I had quite small groups then. So quite small groups, small numbers. So to allocate them a bit per day on daily shifts was, you know, it wasn't a massive area. And to start putting back fences in, I was going to end up like, you know, with troughs everywhere, whereas this I could move every day dead easily. And that set me off really. And that really did give me the bug because I started putting in the back fences. I could see how quick the grass was growing behind them. And then, yeah, I was away. So yeah, we've worked really hard. We've mains fenced the whole farm now, pretty much nearly, like just the perimeter with mains fencing, which has just made it so easy.
Yeah,
it's just a doddle, to be honest. It's so easy now, and the groups have got a little bit bigger. Now we're getting bigger groups coming through, so it is easier to manage bigger groups.
How big a group? How many's in your big
so,
groups?
So this last time we would have been pushing round probably 60 store finishers. This time we'll probably turn out, I think we'll turn out about 75. But out of them 75, we'll pull some out for replacements. So we carved down 100 and I think we carved down 107 this last time. So when we had 98 calves on the floor, 18 of them were pedigree bulls, so they'll stay in. And the other ones will all go out.
So, and the other thing I saw you did was fence line weaning.
Yeah, so outdoor weaning.
Just explain how you do that, kind of physically do it.
So I'd heard loads about it, and in my head I had a completely different perception than how I actually did it. and like I said before, my dad thinks I'm absolutely crazy, and not that he'd love me to fail, but if I failed, he'd mention it quite a few times. So I was like, if I'm going to try this, then I need to speak to someone and give it my best shot because I don't want to try it and it go horribly wrong and be put off trying it again. So I actually mentioned it to the group, to other people in my strategic farm group, and they were all a bit cautious and a bit like, oh no, don't do it. And then I came across James Evans on Twitter, and I'd seen that he'd done quite a bit of it. So I phoned him. I sent him a message and said, oh, can I phone you and speak to you about this? And James, being James, dead great, came back, yeah, completely. So I had a conversation with him on the phone, and it was completely different to how I thought I was going to do it. But I was like, that's the one who's doing it, so let's give it a go. So literally, I'll bring the cows and calves up. I will separate the cows and calves. I'll take the calves back down to a paddock, and they'll go in the paddock, and then literally I'll come straight back, get the cows and put them in the next paddock next to them. And then between them paddocks, I've got two rows of permanent. So I've got like, there isn't a hedge there. I'm trying to draw a picture now, but you can't see.
It's
an open space. It's an open space, but it is dividing between two fields. So I have got a permanent wire, but instead of being one permanent wires, I've got two. So I've got a lower down one, which is there anyway, just because it's dead open. And when we're pushing calves around with the cows to stop them going astray. So that's where I tried it. So I put them there and I thought, you know, the worst that can go wrong is I'll lose a bit of electric fence. It's only a bit of electric fence. It's not, you know, it's not going to break the bank. And then also I put another temporary one about a meter off on the cow side just to stop them, the calves, like trying to stick the heads through and this, that and the other. I think this is the third year we've done it now. Never had any big dramas, to be honest. I think last year I left two cows in with them. Because I thought it might make them easier to. They used to moving round because I'll be moving the cows and calves every 3 days. But I thought it might make them easier to move around the calves, get them a bit less stressed. We're still having two cows with them. Worst thing I ever did, the two cows were an absolute pain in the backside. Absolute pain in the backside, the two cows were. And the only two calves that got out were them two cows' calves. When I took them two cows out about a few days later, it was their two calves that managed to find a way to get out. But yeah, all the others didn't bother. And then gradually, day by day, just move the cows a bit further apart. So move the cows another paddock back. And like 3-4 days, that's it, job done. Then the calves are like loads more healthier. I didn't take a check in the first year. Took a bit of a check in the second year. Not had any signs of any check this year. And again, the weighing's great because you can see what you're doing and double check that things are going well and that things are working that you're trying.
Yeah. So on the grazing side, how technical are you? Be honest, because I think you probably don't have to be that technical, do you?
No, I probably look and I'll probably come across like I'm a lot more technical than I actually am. I'm probably winging it a lot, to be honest. And that is one thing this year that I really wanted to, because we've changed so many things, I really, really wanted to polish up on that and fine tune it. And COVID and stuff, of course, it's not really happened for me somehow.
Are you measuring grass at all?
Am I what, sorry?
Are you measuring?
Yeah, so use a plate meter. So measure roughly pretty much every week on the blocks that we're moving on daily shifts. Or just measure before they're going into it. And by now, you've got a fairly good idea by just looking at it and knowing what they're going into. But that is one thing I do need to fine tune, like how I'm measuring. I probably don't use that data I'm collecting efficiently enough.
But would you say what I'm conscious of is for someone who's just starting with rotational stuff on electric fences, the whole measuring thing and plate meters, it's not essential, is it?
No, God no. And probably when I started on it, I was like, oh, I need to measure the whole farm. It's going to take me all day to do that and this, that and the other. And then I was like, well, I'll just measure this block that I'm doing here. And it was like I said, I had small groups, so I didn't have set paddocks. So I didn't have set fields. I was just leapfrogging fences. So what I mean by that is no one told me this. I thought someone was going to come out and go, right, this is how you're going to do it. And no one ever came. So I had to just like wing it and get my head around it. So basically, I had a big 22 acre field. I put a fence line straight down the middle. So split it in two. I ran a 25 mil water pipe down the middle with 100 meter length. So I could put the trough on. I could drag it forward. I could drag it back. I could attach the next 100 meters on when we were so far down the field. And I measured the grass. I knew the wind for the field. Or the wind from where I put the fence, because I'd either strided it out or I've got a measurement app. So I looked on the app and went, that's 100 meters. So I've split it 100 meters. And then I measured it. And right, there's this much dry matter in here. These calves weigh this much. I want to be giving them 2.5 of the body weight, which is really easy calculation that you'll find on AHDB. And that's how I said about it. So I was like, right, well, if it's 100 meters wide and there's that much dry matter per hectare, then I need to be moving the fence 25 meters a day. So, and that's what I did. So I'd set them fences up that when I went to move them. So the one thing I must say, and I say to everyone, I always think you've got to have the next day set up, because if you go down there and them calves are hungry and you're messing about putting a fence up in front of them, they're going to walk that fence line. They're going to do damage to the ground when it's wet. You want to go down there. You want to open that wire and let them in because they're hungry and they're going to go in and eat it. They're not going to trample it away. They're going in to eat it. So always make sure you got the next day set up. So I typically go down and I'd open that fence into the next block for them. And then I'd shut them in there and then they'd take the day before's fence up from behind them. And I'd leapfrog that forward the other 25 meters. And that's how I did it. And I just leapfrogged down the field. And then once you start doing that, like I say, it is a bit addictive. You get quite addicted to it.
I know, but it's very difficult to say to someone who hasn't got addicted yet, you will get addicted, and surely they always do. But it sounds a bit odd talking about it before.
Yeah.
Bitten. But yeah, and the thing is, it's all what I think is it's kind of it's all financially positive, isn't it?
Oh, and it's so like, you know, electric fencing. Someone said to me once, you know, you could go and spend £1,000 on electric fencing. You get a lot of electric fencing for £1,000. And in the grand scheme of things, I'm not saying I've spent £1,000 on my permanent stuff. I've spent far way above that. But yeah, it's you just got to give it a try. And, you know, some people say, oh, well, your time going and doing that, it doesn't take me any longer to do that than it would to go and look my cows.
Yeah. So just thinking now about, so you're doing some outwintering.
Yep.
You hasn't all been plain sailing.
No. So I was supposed to be outwintering on kale this year. And it failed, so it didn't grow, which was a bit of a... So I was outwintering a lot bigger number of cows this year because the heifers that we carved down, when we carved down a lot of heifers, they could go with the cows because they were just finished their second time round with the calves. So I mixed them together. So I've got a group of 80 cows, and then my other first-time heifers are kept separately. I brought them in. And yeah, so yeah, we'd grown kale before. I like kale. It's relatively simple to grow. It worked. We'd actually this year we trialed doing bales that aren't wrapped. Mm-hmm. So literally what we generally do when we sow the kale is we want to do as little disturbance as possible. So we'll grow the field, get a good cover of grass on it, and then we'll burn it off. We'll burn the middle off. We tend to leave 20 meters around the outside of the field. Yeah. And we don't really touch that, and that's where we feed out the bales, and it's just leaves a bit more root in there to hold them up out of the soil, and I find this works really well for getting access around the field for doing bits of stuff as well. So yeah, so we'd burn the grass off, we'd mow it, go in, bale it, wrap the bales, put them to one side, go in, direct drill the kale in, so we're not disturbing the soil too much at all. And then once we had a rough idea how much dry matter we were going to have, we'd place them bales out. Well, this year we didn't wrap the bales, so we went in, same principle, burned it off, and then did the bales with a belt baler and just put net around them. Yeah. And then literally we went, we've got 110 bales. The field is X amount of meters long. We divided it by two because we tend to put bales at either end of the field just in case, like, cows start bullying each other, which, to be fair, they haven't ever done. So we put a bale at either end of the field, then they can go either, you know, half and go one side, half and go the other side, or whatever they please. And yeah, so we put them straight out. We've not moved them again since. So we left them there. So that was a new thing we were doing this year and seeing how it went on. And then, yeah, and then the kale didn't grow. So I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? So basically, when they sprayed it off, the clover didn't die. And then we took the opinion that if we mowed it really tight, we'd get away with it and the kale should get up and get going ahead of the clover. Anyway, it didn't. The clover swamped it out. So we had to respray to get this clover out. And then we went in with a Italian ryegrass and kale mix, which hasn't got us the amount of dry matter we wanted. So we've had to put more bales in. So we have had to put some wrap bales in as well. And I was really dubious about it. But once we started it now, they love these bales that aren't wrapped. Just can't get over that at all. And that's like, you know, really good saving. We've saved on bale wrap. It's better it's better for our carbon footprint. It's, you know, less time undoing wrap. It's just loads more easier.
And how much waste have you had on each bale?
Very, very little, if any, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that when I went and did the first ones, because like you, if you look around the bale, it's probably like an inch and a half where it's gone a bit slimy on the outside. And I was like, oh, because my cows are pretty fussy too. They are real fussy. And I was like, I'm going to have to like fork this off so they can get into it. Mm. But literally, they just start in the middle and they just eat through it. And there is literally nothing left. So I put a ring feeder over them because I can't get the very bottom bit of net out. So I'll cut the bale as low down as I can get either side and then take the net off. Yep. So it's the last bit of net. And because I'm quite picky, like I don't want to be leaving that net in the soil. So I have a ring feed around it so I can get that last bit of net out dead easy. And yeah, there is literally very, very little left, if anything, some days. And they go for them before they go for the wrap ones that are in there, to be honest. They do really, really love them. And we brought a moisture meter so we could monitor, like, you know, if moisture was getting into them. And they're just like, they are just as dry as a bone in the middle. the bail a bit tighter with a belt bailer and stuff, but yeah, it worked really well.
But it's a kind of, unless you're in a really high rainfall area, it's a bit of a game changer, that, isn't it?
I think so. I'll definitely do it again. It's just, yeah, like I say, just the time it saves on doing the wrap, and then not having to any wrap to get rid of. Never mind the money you're saving by not wrapping them in the first place. And it has worked really, really well. So my general day on that would be, so that some 80 cows, that saves me so much time. If they were inside, I'd be doing the, we've got a cubicle bed, so I'd have to be doing the cubicle beds. Yeah. I couldn't keep as many cows as I'm doing without putting up another shed. And I'll literally go down to them, and in 25 minutes, I can turn the fence off, walk the whole fence, move the fence. So I'm moving the fence maybe about 5 meters a day now.
Yeah.
And then opening, well, there's two bales that aren't wrapped, and there's one bale that's wrapped, and I can do that and be back on the gator by the gate in 25 minutes, and that's
and
it.
And you haven't got the muck to deal with, have you?
No. So save money on spreading the muck, and I try not to plough after. So the first year we did it, it was a very, very kind year. It was 2018. It was a really good winter, and literally went straight in after the cows came out with an SKH crumbler. So it's a little bit like a para-harrow, but manual working. And we went through that a couple of times with it, and then literally went in with an iron bock and seeded it down. And that has just come absolutely fabulous. It just grows grass for fun, even now. Last year, we had a real dry spell, and it sort of just went really, really hard, dead quick after they'd come off. So we took the opinion to plough that, to be honest. It was a field that hadn't had anything done for it for a long time either. So we did plough that. I'm hoping this time we can get away without ploughing. So again, it's saving money there too. And hopefully better, because we're keeping all them nutrients, hopefully, in the top of the soil where we're wanting to grow the grass.
Yeah. So the future, Ian.
Yeah.
How do you see the next 10 years?
So I have got other things. So we've got like a microbrewery. We've got some rentals. We've got like a microbrewery that we rent a building to. Lots of different things. But my argument always is 90% of my time is being a beef farmer. Mm. And I want to be able to earn my living out of being a beef farmer. And I think I should be able to. And that's where up in the numbers came. So I looked at it that in my head, I've got a figure of, say, £30,000 a year I want to be earning my wage. And if you look to that over 70 cows, that's a lot of money per cow. And if there was that sort of money in the job, then there'd be cows everywhere and everyone would be doing it. But if you look at that same figure over a large number of cows, it gets a bit more achievable.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm aiming for, because at the end of the day, I'm a beef farmer. That's what I spend 90% of my time doing. And I should be able to earn a wage off it. And if I can't, I might as well rent my farm out and go and drive a digger again, mightn't I? And, you know, that's the way. And yeah, I say that to everyone, and then I sit here thinking, well, I'm bonkers, because why don't I just do that anyway? It's because I've got a cow addiction and grass addiction. So, yeah, so I have got other things, but I class them as separate.
Yeah, they're like add-ons, aren't they?
Yeah, because I'd add them regardless anyway. Whether I was doing the farm, I'd still have that coming in regardless anyway. So, yeah, so we have toyed around with like meat boxes and stuff. And part of a positive from coronavirus, if there can be one, is I've sort of started doing them a little bit joint with a guy that does industrial barbecues, that rents a unit off me that hasn't got any work on at the minute because he can't do any weddings. So he's sort of taking that on and marketing that. We've started dealing with butchers more direct, with local pub chains and stuff. And I truly believe a lot of that's come from the stuff I've done with AHDB. You know, having a social media presence and telling people and people taking an interest in what I'm doing, and then stuff like the competitions and stuff we've entered. And it can only do good, and that's created like opportunities. It's created a really good network of people that have different thinking, and people you can discuss stuff with and run stuff past and keep you in check at the same time. For me to expand the farm acreage wise isn't going to really be a possibility, and I can only do so much. So I just want to make sure I'm getting the most out of what I'm doing. So my long-term aim would be get up to 150 cows, thereabouts, be TB free, so it didn't bother my pedigree stuff, sell pedigree bull, sell pedigree stock, and also, like, you know, sell to local butchers or more direct?
I think where you are, you could do lots of those things. But Ian, that has been amazing. And thank you very, very much. And I'm sure you're very open and you're...
You've got to be proud of what you do as well. So I was saying to someone the other day, like, the most interesting conversations that I probably have are with, like, vegetarians or vegans. If I can get sat next to one of them at a wedding, then I'm sorted all night then, because I'm proud of what I do. Just a conversation both ways, and explaining to how people see things differently and what I do. And I think farms have got to be more willing to speak to different types of people and stuff. And
Yeah, dead right. Thank you, Ian. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our AHGB podcast. The Strategic Farm Network is part of our Farm Excellence Programme, all about making real on-farm change for better returns. To find out more, visit our website, ahgb.org.uk/farmexcellence.